and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards.
And Augustin Macellari. On today's show, we'll be meeting Anna Meredith to learn more about where pop and classical music collide.
Then we'll be discussing drag as we catch up with Vincent Honoré, who's curating a whole exhibition all about it.
And as cult 80s film Heathers reaches 30, we'll be hearing from its director, Michael Lehman.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy plenty of great music too, ahead, here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, Aug, nice to be in the chair here in Studio One with you again this Sunday lunchtime. There's nowhere I'd rather be on my weekend, not with my young family, no, here in Midori House. And it's been quite the week, a hive of activity.
Papers, magazines.
It's been, I think, a week of profound musical significance of one reason or another.
On Thursday, not only did we have the Queen of Pop reaching her milestone 60th.
And the passing of a real, genuine, bona fide music legend.
The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Mm. Very sad. We'll be hearing a little more about that later.
I think it's time. It's Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
What have you got for us, Faye?
Well, let me remind you guys that it's August, so I wouldn't call it a silly season. I would call it a wonderful season because there's not boring stories around. There's a lot of pop culture stories. And let's start with the VMAs, or it's the Video Music Awards. You know, of course, they've been going on for ages, since the early 80s. Tomorrow, they're happening in New York. And for those that say, who cares about award season, I say, you're wrong. People should care. I think they're very fun and interesting. And, you know, they're a good reason to be here on the news look ahead as well.
Who's going to be the big winners? Do we know already? Who's on the shortlist? Who have you got? Who are you sort of backing?
Well, I'm not backing her, but Cardi B has 10 nominations, but I don't think she will win the most. I think it's the year of Childish Gambino. I mean, he had this excellent clip, This Is America. I believe he has got 8 nominations. And that video, you know, people say, oh, the power of the video clip is not as used to be. But to be honest, it was even a night in one of our news shows when this was released. I mean, it was a fantastic critique of America, and I think he might be performing as well. And you know he's going to get the most important award of the evening. It's called the Michael Jackson Vanguard Award. Jennifer Lopez.
So watch out for that. Monday night, you say?
Monday night.
Intriguing.
On MTV. They still do some music sometimes. It's not only sitcoms.
It's not
about
just lunacy.
Yeah.
Where next, Faye?
Next is a film that has been released this weekend. I find it particularly fascinating. It's Crazy Rich Asians. And guys, this is a very nice trivia. It's the first film with an all-Asian American cast since 1993. That's crazy. The last film was called The Joy Luck Club. But it's nice. It's based on a very famous novel, and it's just a typical rom-com. I mean, the only thing special about this one is that, you know, it's just an all Asian American cast, and it's this simple story of a young Asian American woman. She meets a boy and she doesn't know his family is very rich, in fact one of the richest in Singapore, and when she goes there to visit, she finds out, oh my god, and of course there's some intrigue and some romance.
Intriguing. So we've ticked off music videos, we've ticked off the silver screen. Is there time to tick off something else?
Print. The third edition of the Summer Weekly will be out. And I would like to promo, I did a little story about the one-hit wonders. And actually, I did interview, do you remember Corona?
A group of people? Is Corona one person, actually?
Yeah, so basically, Corona was an Italian outfit, but then they were from, you know, the front woman was a Brazilian singer, Olga Souza. So I spoke to her, you know, how did it feel, you know, to have recorded The Rhythm of the Night? And she compared writing the song as, like, riding a horse. And of course, guys, we have the fourth Summer Weekly. It will be a fashion special. So a lot of nice
plenty
things.
Plenty of top prints to look forward to. Fernando, always great fun. Thanks for your picks of next week's news today here on the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing, well, more about music. Anna Meredith's exciting new collaboration coming up after this. While some experiments with genre blending may be best forgotten, rap metal springs to mind, recent years have seen the breaking down of musical boundaries yield striking, often beautiful results. Classically trained composers, including Niels Frahm and Mika Levy, have applied their institutional training to contemporary music with striking results.
Anna Meredith is at the vanguard of this new line of musical inquiry. An accomplished composer, her ventures into experimental dance music have met with critical acclaim. Now she's probing the borders between pop and classical with even more rigour as her new collaborations offset Vivaldi's iconic Four Seasons against her own composition.
And I'm delighted to say Anna Meredith joins us now on the Monocle Weekly. Congratulations on the whole Anno project. It's sort of incredibly interesting, this idea of a collision, you know, of contemporary and classical. We've seen things a bit like this before, but I'm not sure I've seen one that works as effectively as this. Can we just go back to the beginning? I know that Jonathan Morton from the Scottish Ensemble sort of, he drew some parallels, didn't he, between your work and that of Vivaldi, which must have, that must be quite a nice thing for any composer to hear, right?
Yeah, I mean, when he first approached me about it, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and he was saying that he could imagine a way of hearing Four Seasons, so famous, even if you think you don't know it, you definitely do, you know, and that he could imagine hearing that sort of refreshed and alongside other music, and that he thought I would be a good partner with my music. And I initially thought, this is a terrible idea. There's no way I can do this, you know, on so many levels. I thought, oh my God, it'd be like trying to fit a McDonald's M into your watercolor painting. You know, it's positioning something so iconic. So I was a bit reluctant at first, but it's not me reworking Vivaldi. It's not like Max Richter's piece where he sort of remixed Vivaldi. I've sort of imagined it more as if Vivaldi and I are collaborating on a piece. So I do a bit, then he's got a bit, then I've got a bit, then he's got a bit. But it still spans that idea of a year of Four Seasons like his original piece did, but obviously with some of his bits missing.
That's really interesting to hear about this kind of collaboration from beyond the grave. Your background is in classical music, but you moved towards pop. I kind of wanted to ask about how this has seemed to crop up across music in a way that maybe it hasn't before. And I wanted to hear your kind of reflections on that, whether it's a kind of, you know, with Niels Frahm and things like that, whether it's a sort of uniquely contemporary phenomenon, or if it's kind of always been there.
I think people care less about genres and definitions, which I think is a great thing. And so I suppose, and also I suppose the simplicity and accessibility of electronic software, you know, means that whereas before, maybe if you want to get into electronics 20 or 30 years ago, you're talking about a ton of gear and a load of help and a lot of technical knowledge, whereas now you can just be mucking around on your own with a phone or a laptop. It means you can do it more in your own terms. I think you're also right that it's part of a sort of bigger cultural statement of where we're all at, that, and it goes the other way with loads of pop musicians or electronic musicians who are using acoustic or classical instruments and their stuff too. And I think it's just people, we're able to pick and choose the stuff that we like a bit more and not worry so much about what associations that brings up.
I did wonder whether there's kind of, I was reading around earlier and I saw this great exchange that I'd forgotten about, the Karl Heinz Stockhauser was sort of played an Aphex Twin track. And,
I don't think I've heard that.
He was kind of snooty about it. I think it was Didgeridoo. He was sort of a bit snobby, and Aphex Twin said, you know, he should stop making such random abstract patterns and make something that you can actually dance to. Was his reply. And I wondered if you can relate to that. Is there this kind of tension, or is that something which is dissolving?
Between composers and electronic musicians?
Yeah, or I suppose between what kind of nominally is termed high and low culture.
I think it's so fluid. Like, you know, I mean, to some people, Aphex Twin would seem like it didn't have any beats to dance to. I mean, it's all just, I've had the same piece of music played consecutive nights in totally different locations, once in like a sit-down classical concert hall and the next night in a kind of more grotty bar clubby thing. And, you know, the classical people, some of them will be like, oh, it's so repetitive and so monotonous. And then the next night, the same people will be like, oh, it's too experimental and weird, I can't handle it. So, I mean, I think that kind of whole idea of what something actually is, it just depends on your own background. So, I mean, I'm sure those prejudices and assumptions exist across every world, but it's all just a sliding scale, isn't it?
I suppose the important thing is to disrupt, and we perhaps use that term disruptive too much, though it was striking that I know Jonathan Morton talked about disruption being necessary when looking at these things. And he said that your work is disruptive by nature, which I assume he means in a purely complimentary way, of course. But just on that point, if you're working with classical musicians, I know you've talked a little bit about collaborating here, of course, with the Scottish Ensemble artists themselves. To really refine your art as a classical performer, you can't be too disruptive, right? You need to be anything but that to sort of get high up in... I don't know, is there a sort of a contradiction there, or is there a conflict at all between when to disrupt?
You're definitely right that as a player, to a certain degree, you have to be able to play the notes. If there's sheet music in front of you, there's definitely lots of flexibility and room for interpretation. And that's one thing I love about how John Morton and Scottish Ensemble have done with this record, is that they've not just played for the Vivaldi, which they must have played hundreds of times before, but they've thought of it as if from scratch, and they've looked for new ways in to play this material, which they could have just churned out. But you're right that to a certain degree, as a player, you have to be, in some respects, a technician. But I don't think of myself as a disruptor. Would be to me a bit of a strange starting point. I think that was a very nice thing he said, and I also hope he meant it as a compliment, but I don't think it's something that certainly I would set out to do. If it, again, that's just like, you know, what's disruptive to some people. Nigel Kennedy playing things at slightly different speeds was like the most crazy thing other people can think of, and to other people, what's the big deal about, I don't know, something being played on kazoos, or I don't know, it's all relative again, isn't it? You know, to some people, taking a pint into a concert hall is the most, is a lowering of the tone and of classical music, and to other people, it's still a very stuffy, uptight environment.
So did the performers then, did they find it liberating? Because I know there's also a dynamism in performative terms, that the players move, and obviously there's the very striking backdrop with the visuals by Eleanor Meredith, of course, in the background. So the whole thing is more dynamic, is that fair? And how conscious were you of the need for the performative element to sort of marry up again and be challenging and be something that was very innovative?
I was really lucky that the Scottish Ensemble are some of the best technical players I've ever worked with. They are just astonishingly good. So, but also they have a history as an ensemble of doing slightly unusual things. They've done projects working with choreographers where they've even been kind of dancing about, and they do play a lot of standard repertoire, but they are questioning the whole time what performance is. So we came to the whole project with that mindset. So this piece doesn't, you know, they're not dancing about, but I feel like everything is in service of this idea of this year. So of the piece basically kind of moves from left to right. So you, as an audience, you sit in the middle, the players stand at the start of the piece kind of to your left, and a lot of the visual on screens, which are also wrapped around you along with the speakers, is kind of to the left. And then during the hour, the focus broadly moves over to the right and the players move around as well. So what's nice about it is, as an audience member, you're really, really close to the players. They're right around you. You know, you're probably only a couple of metres away from this astonishing virtuosity. And I think there's a really visceral kind of immediacy when you watch people, when you can see rosin or dust like flying off a bow when it's that close to you, as opposed to that sometimes slightly detached concert hall feeling you can get where you're watching people on a stage. This way, because the players are spread apart individually, you can really hone into what an individual is doing and what their part is. And that's, as an audience member, a really exciting experience. In terms of their performance, I think they really look for connections. So I think some of the way they've performed the Vivaldi, you know, John would say, hey, do you remember that bit in Anna's piece where we tried to play the piece a bit more? He might say like sol pont, which means a way of playing the violin nearer the bridge of the violin, which makes it sound very metallic and removes a lot of the richness of the sound. And he might say, let's play this bit of Vivaldi a bit like that. So it kind of creates links. So I think I was really lucky that they were stepping back from the whole project to look at ways to link it all together.
I'm really interested in that sort of experimenting with performativity and pushing it and this sort of attention that you're paying to audience experience and how they interact with the music in a sort of multi-sensory way. Is it important for you as a composer to push yourself artistically and to not stick to within the bounds and limits of your medium, but to look outwards?
For me, it is, yeah. I mean, I definitely am not saying that every single classical concert should be done with visuals and lights and, you know, smoke. You know, it's not saying that that's the way to sex up classical music. But for me, I always want to, as much as I can, try and think about what it's like for a performer and try and find a way to put someone as much as I can in the middle of the sound. You know, when I'm writing, I'm always trying to make music that's quite direct, that is very clear, and I keep overusing this word visceral, but for me it's really important. If I feel that the music has energy and has shape, then I want that to be communicated as clearly as possible. So I'm trying to think about ways to not create a barrier to that for an audience member. So, you know, in this instance, yeah, we were really lucky that we did think about everything from, you know, how did the audience come into the space? What's the lighting like? What this audio playing when the audience come into the space so that they're already in the environment? How does the piece end? Just little things like that, that I think help you make the leap into the world of the piece, you know, without having to sort. It's not like sitting in a house lights up concert hall and then the lights go down and that's the moment that the thing changes into it. It's helping you sort of just come with us on the journey, I guess, without having to feel like you're changing gear to get into that kind of world.
Anna, can I just ask you a bit about how you actually work? I always find it interesting on this programme, whether we're talking to writers about how they write or filmmakers about how they conceive ideas and shoot them, to composers and how they compose. You're pretty busy. You did. We had 5 telegrams earlier, obviously all this stuff in Edinburgh. Am I right in saying you're still working on your next album? Is that right? Do you default into different sort of working modes depending on whether you're in the studio or looking for something to perform or whether you're revisiting older pieces? Does your sort of mindset, your actual working practices change with the projects?
I try really hard on a sort of musical level to not make any distinction with whatever I'm doing. So whether I'm writing an orchestra piece or a remix or a piece for kids, to me it's all the same musical building blocks. It's all the same material. So just played by different forces and different contexts. And, you know, in the way that I actually technically write music is that it's all about this plotting, this pacing of material, the shape and the context of the ideas is the most important thing to me. So before I write any bit of music, I like to do a big graphic map, a sort of map timeline plan of the pieces to help me sort of map out the shape of the ideas and how they sit next to each other, and then, you know, zoom in on one of those shapes for one moment and look at what that might mean to be that sort of, I don't know, triangular build-up shape, and what kind of materials might need to be at the start or at the peak of the build. So I always do these big maps for everything just to help me. So like with the Anno piece, I had the Vivaldi shapes because they were pre-existing, so I was able to draw a timeline of an hour, map in the shapes of the movements of his pieces that I was going to use, and then that helped me sort of work out what needed to sit alongside those to either contrast it or set it up, that sort of thing. So that sort of plotting stage is super important to me.
And do you find that the kind of commissions and things that you worked on, I mean, do they come to inform your sort of personal practice in maybe ideas that come up as you're working on them?
Definitely. I mean, for example, I wrote a beatbox concerto ages ago, and then, you know, I'd never heard of beatboxing before that. And then after that, I did a piece for body percussion for a whole orchestra where they put down their instruments to do body percussion. And then at some point they moved into beatboxing, which I wouldn't have known how to do, but if I hadn't done the beatboxing piece. I like having a real mix of stuff that has been other people coming to me saying, hey, we've got an idea, can you do it? And then stuff like the album band stuff, which has been entirely me turning down commissions to create time to make something. So that kind of mix of someone else saying, do you think you could make this work, and me starting from scratch with no considerations at all.
And I want to ask you a little bit about your broader creative motivations. I wondered whether you would ever conceive of a work, or whether you might be tempted, given current times, into a work that was maybe more sort of political in character. Not wishing to say, oh, you know, would you ever sort of shoehorn some clunky political message into a piece of work? But it seems a strange time, and many people are sort of looking to the creative industries to give them some relief from the sort of grim day-to-day reality of politics and all the rest of it. Are you a sort of a political person? Do you think that would sort of bleed into your compositions, perhaps?
Not at the moment musically. I mean, I've been asked to write a couple of pieces in response to things. And while I might support those things personally or do take steps to do stuff away from music, it doesn't, so far, you know, never know, but so far it hasn't been the right starting point for me to actually kind of try and make some new content. That being said, maybe if I actually just plunged in, it would, but it doesn't feel right now the most obvious connection. So I feel all I can do on that front is try and make good, strong, good music that is, you know, meant genuinely and not cynically, and is, you know, at times hopefully a bit joyful or a bit, you know, pushes you or discomforting or whatever it is, and that that offers, like you say, a different space to that.
Anna Meredith's work with the Scottish Ensemble is available to buy or stream now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
I think it's time for more music now. Now, I mentioned at the top of the show the passing of legendary American soul queen Aretha Franklin. We're going to hear a little more about her extraordinary life in a second or two from our own Andrew Muller. But first, let's hear from the lady herself.
Sweet baby, there's something that I've just got to say. Baby, baby, sweet baby, you let me hurt in a real cold way. Speak your name, and I feel free. You said I do.
That was the late, great Aretha Franklin, who sadly passed away at the age of 76 last Thursday. Here's Andrew Muller to tell us more about the life of a cultural icon.
It wasn't the kind of voice you hear twice in a lifetime. Aretha Franklin was routinely hailed as the greatest singer in American history, even recognizing that both her homeland and popular music have tendencies towards hyperbole. It's a tough statement to argue with. Franklin's voice was an extraordinary instrument in and of itself, and she commanded it with a virtuoso certainty. There wasn't a thing she couldn't sing. She had hits and banked classics in gospel, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, jazz and pop. When Aretha Franklin sang a song, it stayed sung. Aretha Louise Franklin was born on March 25, 1942, in Memphis, Tennessee. If that birthplace was naturally fertile ground for a budding gospel singer, Franklin's parentage was even more propitious. Her father was a popular Baptist preacher famed for his expressive and dramatic sermons, her mother an accomplished piano player. After a couple of early relocations, Franklin spent most of her childhood in another city which would become synonymous with a post-war renaissance in black popular music, Detroit, where from the age of 10 she began lighting up her father's services at home and on the road with a voice which would, in short order, thrill the world.
Rock-a-bye, your baby with a Dixie melody.
Franklin started early in every respect. When she made her first recordings, she was 15 and pregnant with her second child. At 18, she signed to Columbia Records, with whom she had her first chart success, but who didn't know quite what to do with her. Atlantic Records did. Her first album for Atlantic, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You, recorded in early 1967 at Fame Studio in Alabama with the mighty Muscle Shoals rhythm section, included a top 10 hit with the title track and an anthem for the ages with Franklin's subtly rewritten version of an Otis Redding tune.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
The run of albums Franklin issued in the late 1960s and early 1970s stands as one of the great streaks of freakish brilliance. Her voice, while so astonishing as to seem almost an unfair advantage, was not all there was to it. Franklin's choices of songs and collaborators on 1968's Lady Soul and 1972's Young, Gifted and Black in particular was unerring. However familiar to listeners any song might have been, she was able to make it instantly and unarguably her own. Franklin's prominence amid the burgeoning of the civil rights movement lent her gravitas, and she embraced the opportunity and the responsibility. In 1968, she sang at the funeral of Martin Luther King Jr., a friend of her father's. In later decades, as a hopeful symbol of how much America had changed, she performed at three presidential inaugurations.
God bless America. My home, sweet home.
In the early 1980s, Franklin was introduced to a new generation of fans via an electrifying show-stealing cameo in cult film The Blues Brothers.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
You better think about what's trying.
And while they're not going to be what she is most and best remembered for, her forays into breezy, pristine 1980s pop were none too shabby, whether duetting with George Michael and the Eurythmics or on her own. In her later decades, Franklin recorded and toured less frequently, becalmed by rickety health and a fear of flying. But any doubts about the power of the old magic were dispelled in December 2015, when she raised the roof of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and brought a tear to the eye of President Barack Obama, along with pretty much everyone else present. Obama later said of Franklin that nobody embodies more fully the connection between the African-American spiritual, the blues, R&B, rock and roll, the way that hardship and sorrow were transformed into something full of beauty and vitality and hope. American history wells up, Obama said, when Aretha sings. He was right. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thanks, Andrew. You're with the Monocle Weekly, here on Monocle 24.
To some, it might seem tacky, even kitsch, but for many years, drag has been at the forefront of cultural and social change. Its practitioners have transformed themselves figuratively and literally, and in doing so, opened up exciting new vistas of identity for exploration.
Not only has drag facilitated social change, it also has a long and storied visual language behind it. The aesthetics and impact of drag are the subject of a new exhibition at London's Hayward Gallery. Monocle's own Paige Reynolds caught up with curator Vincent Honoré to hear more about it.
Do you think that as our ideas of gender are changing, so it's not so much a spectrum between male on the one end and sort of female on the other end, do you think that people kind of have a more nuanced understanding of what drag is?
I would hope so, that drag indeed is not necessarily questioning gender, but questioning humanity and how we can reinvent itself beyond boundaries.
Drag has sort of often been quite underground, so more of a sort of subculture. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
I'm not sure, actually. I think drag has always been part of the mainstream. I mean, drag embraces performances, Hollywood, star systems, fashion systems. If you think about, for instance, the 1962 film Some Like It Hot, it was about drag. And in the 20s, cabaret and drag cabaret were very, very popular. So I'm not sure it was so underground.
Okay.
And nowadays you have RuPaul, you have like Bjork, her last cover was, she was styled by a drag artist from Berlin, Hungary. Maybe it's becoming more popular nowadays, but I think it was never really underground.
It's interesting you say, obviously, RuPaul's Drag Race really obviously has brought drag into TV screens across the world, really. I'm interested, actually, that I think even sort of the first six or seven seasons of that, often it was quite traditional sense of drag, so it was often men dressing as women. Do you think that drag as an art form often plays with a less linear idea of drag?
Mm-hmm. Working on this exhibition, I spoke a lot with very different drags. And as much as I respect RuPaul and I think what he did and what he does is very important, it's only one of the aspects of drag. And this is why we are trying to show in this exhibition the multiple voices of how this art form can really create a discourse around gender, race and class and taste and culture and multiple contemporary issues.
And when you were going about sort of choosing the artists and curating it, something that's not linear, how were you able to categorize it? Is it like a historical walkthrough?
I think the main question I ask myself is how not to categorize drag and really not trying to put together a history that doesn't belong to me, but that belongs to a community. I just set up some very basic boundaries, such as time. I started in the 60s. So one of the very first artwork in the exhibition is by Pierre Molinier from 65 and then by Sturtevant in the late 60s. And I decided to really include artists from very different generations and international artists and have a polysemy of drags. In the way I will install the exhibition, I really do not want to have a linear history, something that would be chronological, something that would be institutionalized. I think drag should not be institutionalized. So it would be like a cabinet, a little bit like if you enter a sort of green room in a cabaret, you have all the pictures of the previous queens and kings. And I was very influenced by that. I thought it could be very interesting to have that as well cross-generational exhibition where, for instance, works by Victoria Sin, who was born in the 90s, will be shown together with works by Mapplethorpe, Robert Mapplethorpe, or Cindy Sherman, or Eleanor Antin of a previous generation, because they are all of them are relevant at the same level. As well as I didn't want to do like the kind of traditional curators tours, so I invited some drag queens from London to do the tours on my behalf, so really to give the show back to the community.
That's amazing. I was actually going to ask you sort of whether you consulted with drag queens and kings, obviously, to kind of reflect the amount of voices you're trying to represent. I also thought it's interesting when I'm thinking of drag, I often think of drag as performance, so of it being really alive. And obviously through art, maybe sometimes that's a little bit difficult to capture. Do you have installations? Do you have a performance art element to the exhibition?
Indeed, you're right. Drag is mainly, it's the core of drag is being a performance and usually a political performance. In this exhibition, we are solely showing self-portraits. So we are excluding everything that has to do with documentation. We don't have works by Diane Arbus. We don't have works by Nan Goldin, for instance. It was very important. It was the artist's voice and the artists themselves enacting the drag. And in that sense, they are performances because they are most of them are performances for cameras. We have a very few example of documentation of performances by Rose English, for instance. But most of them had been made for the camera.
I know that part of the exhibition also, I guess, explores like selfie culture, so that self-representation. Do you think that as a sort of generation using social media more and more to represent versions of ourselves, do you think that is really important and that plays into it?
I think one of the factors why drag is so popular, I think it's because it represents endless possibilities of reinventing yourself. So indeed, in that selfie culture, it really speaks to people.
Obviously, the gender debate is sort of one of our the big debates of our generation. But the artists in this exhibition, they're not just probing gender norms. They're questioning systems of oppression relating to sexuality, race, class, consumerisms. Are there any social or political questions that you really wanted to shine a light on that were really important for you?
Well, I think if you look at the documentary, the 90s documentary, Paris is Burning, clearly you understand that drag is not necessarily about gender, it's about class. It's about reversing systems of class and oppressions. In that exhibition, it will be clearly shown with the work by Joe Spence, for instance, and others. Artists will be quite critical of a society of consumerism. There will be some post-colonial discourses with the work by Ming Wong or Samuel Fosso. I hope that the exhibition will show that drag is much more complex than we think it is.
So drag is clearly questioning a lot of things, a lot of very important questions. But do you think it's still a very important space for the queer community? Are you still keen to focus in on that?
Yes, but the exhibition will not solely include queer artists. We have a lot of drag kings and some cisgender artists embracing drag. As much as drag is very, very important for the queer community, I think as well it expands beyond that boundary.
I'm interested you're talking about drag kings.
Yeah.
I feel like actually women sort of performing as men or, you know, wearing men's clothes has actually happened sort of for a very long time. But the term drag king is quite new. Mm-hmm. Have there always been as many drag kings as drag queens? As you were sort of researching all of this, what did you find?
I think in my research, I think that drag queens were more popular than drag kings. But drag kings had been existing since the 20s, I would say, yeah. Well, we start with Sturtevant in the late 60s, and then Valley Export is doing this fantastic work in 68, Identity Transformation. Eleanor Antin is one of the drag kings. Actually, the drag kings that we have in the exhibition mainly comes from feminist movements in the late 60s and early 70s, and we have a few of them in that exhibition.
I think drag has always been quite a sort of, obviously quite a defiant art form and also quite joyful. Do you think we're living in obviously quite heavy and slightly depressing political times, do you think that drag's a really important art form in the current sort of political climate?
I think so. I came to realize that drag became very popular with artists in the 60s and 70s. And the factors for this popularity, I believe, was that performance was becoming quite popular within artists. And at the same time, political engagement was crucial at that time. And I feel like possibly that's why drag is nowadays having more attention from artists, because performance is very important as an art form. And at the same time, we need to be politically engaged more than ever.
I think what you seem to find when you ask people about drag, if they are a fan, they're extremely fanatic about it. They really love it. What is it about drag that gets people so excited?
I believe it's such a subtle, engaged, entertaining form of critique that really touches upon very different systems of entertainment, from theatre to fashion to stand-up comedy. Drag are extraordinarily funny. I mean, there's a lot of humour in drag as well. And at the same time, it's not a shallow humour. It really touches upon very crucial, essential identity crises and debates in the society.
Do you have a personal favourite artist in the exhibition, or someone that you really relate to for a specific reason?
Oh, that would be very difficult to name just one artist among the 30 we have in this exhibition, and they are all extraordinary. I'm very glad that indeed we have some very famous names in this exhibition, like Cindy Sherman, Robert Mapplethorpe, together with less known artists that I hope people will discover, such as Susie Lake, who did this fantastic slide piece that influenced Cindy Sherman. She did that slide piece in the early 70s. I'm very happy that the estate of Sturtevant agreed for the work to be included in this exhibition. Sturtevant never claimed to be influenced by feminism or anything else. But if you look at her work, she was someone who, over the course of her career, was appropriating the style of artists, and especially male artists. So she was doing, if you wish, copies of Andy Warhol, Joseph Beuys, and Frank Stella. And in the exhibition, we have a work where she copied a photograph of Marcel Duchamp by Man Ray. And Marcel Duchamp was one of the very first artists using drag. with Eros C'est la vie, in a photograph taken by Manet. And I think this work is very emblematic of what drag can be in many ways, of appropriation, but as well a critical discourse around that particular appropriation.
Amazing.
As well, I'm very excited to see what Adam Christensen will do for the opening reception on the 21st of August. He will do a new performance. Adam is a fantastic singer and performer based in London. So that's possibly an event not to miss.
Thank you, Vincent. And Drag, Self-Portraits and Body Politics opens at London's Hayward Gallery this Wednesday, the 22nd of August.
This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari. Now, any fan of high school movies, that's you, Aug, will be well aware of the 1988 cult classic Heathers. The comedy was the breakout film for its stars, Winona Ryder and Christian Slater, and takes a satirical look at high school life with a rather dark twist.
Despite its zingy one-liners and intelligent take on the tribes and traumas of teenagehood, it wasn't without its controversies and wasn't a box office hit upon release. However, Heathers has had enduring success, finding generations of diehard fans and going on to inspire the likes of my favourite film, the smash hit Mean Girls.
Now, in celebration of its 30th anniversary, the film's been restored and re-released for a limited cinematic run. Monocle's Holly Fisher met with the director, Michael Lehman, to learn more.
Hello, Heather.
Veronica, finally, I got a note of Kurt Kelly's. I need you to forge a hot and horny but realistically low-key note in Kurt's handwriting, and we'll slip it onto Martha Dumbchuck's lunch tray.
Shit, Heather, I don't have anything against Martha Dumbstock.
You don't have anything for her either. Come on, it'll be very. The note will give her shower nozzle masturbation material for weeks.
I do remember the moment I read the script. It was given to me by my friend Larry Karaszewski, who was Dan Waters' old high school buddy. And I knew Dan, and I'd heard that this script was amazing. And Larry and Dan were asking me if I would show it to my agent so Dan could get representation. So I didn't read it with the intention of directing it. I read it just to see what the fuss was about. I'd heard how good it was from my friends. And I read a very long version, and I thought it was incredible. I thought it was amazing. And I did not think that I would be directing it because that's not why it was given to me. I wished I could direct it, but at that point I was still trying to launch a career as a director. I hadn't done anything yet.
And Dan famously wanted Kubrick to do it. It's a pretty good person to play second fiddle to.
I was not in any way offended that I had to wait for Stanley Kubrick to pass before I could do the movie.
And when you're making something like this that deals with things that you know are going to be controversial, do you have it in mind that you might be making a bit of a cult classic?
No, you don't really think about it that way. You don't think the words cult classic at all. It's so difficult to make a good movie, and even though this was my first one, I'd been around long enough to know how hard it is. You're really just hoping that you can find some way to get even close to what you have in your head. You always set out to make a great film. You always figure that by the time you're shooting, you've lined up your ducks and you've got everything where it needs to be to make, if not a great film, a really good film. You know, you don't go into it saying, well, it's not really going to work, but I'm going to make it anyway. So in the case of Heathers, the script was extraordinary, and there was no question. And by the time we were ready to shoot it and Dan had honed it down and we'd put it in shape to be shot, I remember very strongly that I was extremely lucky to have a script that was that good and that was that complex and that had that kind of humor in it, which I, you know, as an arrogant young guy making his first movie, I thought, I get this humor. I know how to do this. This is something that I can really, really work with. As to whether the movie would work as a whole or not, or whether it would be successful, no, you're not even thinking that far ahead.
And do you think that the fact that you guys were such young filmmakers, and the cast are also so young as well when they made it as well, do you think having that youth on your side is what made this film so good? Do you think an old director could make a film about high school like this?
I don't think that an older director would make quite the same kind of movie about high school. Even, you know, at the time, I turned 30 making that movie, and I already questioned at that point whether I was too old to be making a movie about high school, and my memories of high school were very fresh. But today, I would have a different perspective in making a movie about teenagers or high school, And I don't know what it would be. It wouldn't, I mean, there was the enthusiasm of being young, and there was the freshness of that high school experience that did help.
Obviously, we've got Winona Ryder and Christian Slater in their lead roles and very early roles in their careers as well. What did they bring to those characters that maybe you didn't see in the characters when you first started working on the film?
Well, Winona was, it's weird, she was perfect for that role. I could tell the moment that I met her. She came in to meet with us. I don't remember her auditioning. I think she just came in to take a meeting because I'd seen enough of her work in little movies and things that she'd done to know that I thought she was in the realm and she was working, and I think we were in a situation where we could make an offer to her if we wanted her. So she came in for a meeting, and she got in the elevator with me on the way up to the meeting. So we awkwardly met in an elevator on our way up to have an official meeting. The moment she stepped in that elevator, I thought, this girl is going to be so perfect for this role. So I never had any doubts. And what she brought was an actualization of what was on the page that was kind of extraordinarily correct. She hit it right. She looked right. She spoke right. She had the right attitude. She could play the humor of the piece. You know, she's sort of, it's so rare that this happens, but she really was perfectly suited to it. And she was 16 years old. She was an actual teenager. So she had this real authenticity to her.
Hi, I'm sorry. Technically, I did not kill Heather Chandler, but hey, who am I trying to kid, right? I just want my high school to be a nice place. Amen. Did that sound bitchy?
With Christian, he came in and auditioned late in our process because we could not find anybody who we thought was really right to play that role. It was very difficult, and it's partly because younger actors, I think, you know, if you follow the cliche that guys mature a little bit later than girls, a lot of these guys just didn't really bring that much to it. And when Christian came in, it was such a breath of fresh air, because he had all these qualities that really worked for the part. It was a little different than I'd conceived it, but the moment he auditioned, the feeling was, oh yeah, this is the guy. And we brought him in to read with Winona just to make sure, and that cemented that idea. We knew then that they were going to be great.
And it wasn't a huge box office hit when it came out, but it's been such an enduring success. What do you think it is about this film that has captured the imaginations of new watchers throughout the last 30 years?
I think that the particular humor of this piece, the nature of the language, the way the humor is played, the darkness of the humor, provides a take on high school that nobody else has ever really done. So this still stands on its own. You know, the movie's been influential in many ways, but Dan's writing is so specifically great that people who imitate him, they do well, but it's not quite the same. His voice is very particular. And we did have a terrific cast. And so, you know, I'm surprised that people are still talking about it 30 years later, but when I think about it and think, well, why would they be? There are a lot of good reasons why it still kind of has a life.
I remember the first time I saw Heather's, I think I must have been in my early 20s, and my sister introduced it to me because it's her favourite film of all time. She's dressed up as Heather One. She loves it. She does look a bit like her, actually. Yeah. And it was kind of just presented to me as, watch this movie about high school. And then when you don't know what it's actually happens in it, it's a massive surprise. It takes you down a road that you're never expecting to go down. And I think even just from the cover of the film, you don't really know what's going to happen. Did you want that element of surprise? Did you want people to know the full story before they came in, or did you want them to come in and be shocked?
I think I wanted people to come in and be shocked. There was this thing, it was you could tell from the script. But it's funny, scripts are very abstract. They don't have a life to them. And I kept thinking, as we would do our rehearsals and our reads and as we were doing the casting, I thought, this movie, if it works, is going to suck people in by making them think they're watching a certain kind of comedy and then take them down a very dark path. And it's still funny when it goes down the dark path, but it's also emotionally disturbing. And that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted, because I felt like it needed to be grounded in genuinely complicated emotions.
The 90s were a particularly prime time for high school movies. I feel like they're not made so much anymore, maybe because people are too interested in superheroes and vampires and things like that. But which other films, apart from Heather's, were kind of the standout high school movies for you?
I really liked the movie Election. I just thought that that was brilliant. And I think part of the reason why I liked it so much is because I'd made Heathers before that. So I'd made a high school movie, and I'd seen a lot of high school movies. And that one just struck me as, A, it was completely different than Heathers, and B, it was really terrific, and Reese Witherspoon was amazing, and it was a well-made movie. So that one always stands out for me. I can't think of anything that was done more recently. You know, I liked Mean Girls, which was a kind of a Heathers variant. I liked it a lot, but it didn't affect me that strongly. So, you know, I'm not sure what's been done since then. There's nothing else set in high school that has affected me, but it's hard for me to tell because I made a high school movie a long time ago. So, you know, I approach them all differently.
But what do you think it is for a successful movie within that genre for you, not necessarily at the box office? What does it have to capture? What is the essence of a good teen high school movie?
I'm not that interested in your typical coming-of-age teen movie, even though some of them are excellent and they have great performances. But I think that the social life in high school, and this is reflected in Heathers and in Election, it's so complicated. You know, trying to figure out what your place is in that world is the real coming-of-age, but also an acknowledgement that adolescence is in many ways when you enter adolescence thinking you're going to enter the world of grown-ups and that your life is going to become so much bigger and so much better. And what you find out is that it just gets so much darker. And I like movies that convey that because that's not necessarily the standard view of adolescence. You know, you're not embarking on a happy journey.
Definitely not. One thing I've always wondered is how, I mean, maybe this is more of a question for Daniel, but how you arrived at the name Heathers as the title and as the character name?
That's definitely a Daniel question, and it's so clever. I remember when I read the really long version of the script, the first thing I thought is this going to work? Will people actually get the idea that they're all named Heather? Is this something that's too intellectual, too heady? And it works so well on screen. You know, it works early in the movie where they refer to each other as Heather, and you realize, oh my God, they're all named Heather. And this was a brilliant conception from Dan. You know, it came from him. And I don't know if people really realize or remember now. You know how certain names become emblematic of their time? The name Heather for a girl then, it was one of those, like, there were too many girls named Heather, and they all seemed to be the pretty blondes who dominated everybody.
Yeah, and you don't get so many anymore.
No, I don't know. There must be a current, what's the current equivalent to Heather?
Oh, gosh, I've got no idea. When I was at school, there was a lot of Jades and Lauras.
Aha, yes. And maybe Jennifers in the United States at a certain point. But people are more creative with their names now anyway.
If you're going to openly be a bitch.
It's just Heather. Why can't we talk to different kinds of people?
Fuck me gently with a chainsaw. Do I look like Mother Teresa? If I did, I probably wouldn't mind talking to the Geek Squad.
You see that? Heather number one just looked right at me.
Yeah, you've talked in other interviews about how Heathers could never be made now. I mean, for obvious reasons, because of the topics that it covers and events that have happened since Heathers was made. But do you think that's also indicative of Hollywood playing it safe at the moment?
Well, Hollywood has always played it safe. Hollywood was playing it safe when we made Heathers. It wasn't as if all the studios came to us and said, how much money would you like to make this movie? It was way out of the mainstream. So, you know, I think it's very hard to get a dark comedy made because they generally don't perform that well at the box office. So people who spend money to make movies, they generally want to make their money back or make a profit. So you're always involved in a risky proposition when you make truly dark satirical comedy. But I keep thinking now, because basically every one of us who has a smartphone has a movie studio in their pocket. So somebody should be making really dark, really funny stuff because they don't have to depend on a studio to do it. But I haven't seen that yet.
And just finally, what do you reckon JD and Veronica would make of high school in 2018?
Oh, that's such a good question. I don't know. You'll have to ask them.
I prayed for the death of Heather Chandler many times. And I felt bad every time I did it, but I kept doing it anyway. Now I know you understood everything. Praise Jesus. Hallelujah.
That was Michael Lehman there on the 30th anniversary of Heathers, which you must remember the first time round there, Tom.
I don't see why that's funny. I remember it quite well. I didn't see it when it was in theatres, if that's what you're getting at. But yes, I was aware of it in the, what, throughout the early to mid-1990s. Well, there we have it, Org. Another edition of the Monocle Weekly bites the dust. I must say, what a delight. You're actually on the wrong side of the glass, aren't you? Because you are in the presenter's and producer's chair this week.
Doubling up.
Well done, though.
Thank you.
Congrats. Thanks to the powers behind the throne, the eminence grise, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough, who put the show together as always. We'll be back, of course, at the same time next week. Could be you and I, Org, in the chairs. Could be someone else.
Who's to say perhaps Rob Bound will be back from his epic journeys abroad?
There's only one way to find out. You have to tune in at the same time next week. But that is all from me, Tom Edwards.
And it's all from me, Augusta Macellari.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.